over a long period of time, you can have a small amount of power for a long period of time, even though you generated it very, very quickly and stored it in the battery. So if you play with duty cycles and you invert them or spread them out, you can make power look very, very interesting. So it looks like you're getting very, very high power for free, but it's really not. It's just really how you have to break down each time frame and look at how much energy and power was being made in one area and then how well it's being dissipated in another. And I think then it'll all make sense to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I quickly respond to this.
Let me go back to the previous subject now before we lose it, and that is the stored energy in a permanent magnet. The material that you and I call a permanent magnet, or something that's capable of being a permanent magnet, has a whole bunch of little chunks inside that are called domains, and within each one of those domains, most of those molecules are all lined up in such a way that those orbits of those electrons are somewhat parallel to each other. But those individual domains are kind of randomly distributed in various directions. You then put an extremely powerful coil, for instance, an electromagnet around this material, and apply an extremely strong magnetic field. You force all of those domains to line up. You are physically moving those individual domains into a new set of positions. You've done work when you do that. I suspect some heating takes place at the molecular level of that permanent magnet, and you've applied energy. And yes, it's now in the form of a potential energy of that magnetic field that you supplied when you magnetized that material. You've caused all those domains to line up. And depending on the coercivity of the material in question, let me drop. If you're using a material that has the right design, so that it has high coercivity, that really means that those domains really don't want to move against each other. It takes a lot of force or raw energy to move them against each other. And once you force them to all line up to make your magnet, your permanent magnet, they really resist going back to the way they used to be. However, they do, but very slowly. Because of normal thermal energy, a certain number of those domains will flip back. Every magnet you've ever measured, you can measure it today and you measure it 10 years later. Depending on the quality of the materials, it'll be very close to the original magnetic field, but a tiny bit lower. And you can really expand that rate at which it loses by heating up the magnet. You take almost any permanent magnet and you heat it to a glowing temperature. You ain't got a magnet anymore. So thermally, Mother Nature is forcing a certain number of those domains to flip back to the way they used to be, and it slowly loses some of that magnetic field. But you've done work to establish that. But now, with reference to Wesley's two toroidal magnets on a plastic rod, let me approach that one for a minute. I've got two permanent magnets that are in the form of a toroid. And they're magnetized in the axial manner of the toroid, not in the circumferential manner, but in the axial manner. And so I put one magnet in the bottom of the stack with north aiming up, and I put another magnet on top with north aiming down. And the two magnets resist each other. They repel each other. And they come together let me make a guess, they come together with 2 inches of spacing. And I decide to push on the upper one, to push it from 2 inches apart down to 1 inch apart. Once I know the strength of the magnetic field, I have a predictable amount of force that's required for each millimeter of motion that I'm forcing with my fingers. And if I let go of that upper magnet, it will spring back. And I get all of that stored energy that I've done some work. I've applied a force through a distance, I've done some work, I've made an investment of some energy into that system. I've compressed those two magnets closer together, not too different than compressing a spring. If I choose just the right kind of a spring, I can get the exact same force versus distance when I compress a spring as when I push those two magnets together. And when I slowly let go of that spring, I get that stored energy back, when I slowly let go of those two magnets, I get that exact same amount of energy back. So in that particular experiment, there may not be any mysterious energy. What I put in and what I get out are very close to the same, whether it be a spring or two magnets. That's my belief. Let me pass that part over to Wesley to see if he agrees or disagrees with that. N2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait 4 seconds.
Well, I disagree. Because if you're feeding something with a battery, you actually transferring the energy from one form to the other. What you're doing in here is you're not powering the magnet. You're not delivering the power, the energy to the magnet. What is actually happening is the magnet is reusing its own energy the same way as a scalar wave does in order to recover. It has nothing to do with your work. Actually, we're talking about the balance of the energy of your finger. It's the balance of the energy in your body. But this is not transfer of the energy. At that point, I would say we have a mysterious energy and we have over unity, because the unity is 100%. Now, that 100% of return plus whatever energy is being used to recover. Back to you.
Okay, let me keep it simple and let's not use any electromagnets. Let's just use two permanent magnets. And the two permanent magnets are toroidal permanent magnets. And I set up this robot, which is going to push down on the upper magnet that normally was being suspended by those opposing magnetic fields. And what that magnetic field is, and I'll admit that that's a bit of a mystery, but there's a magnetic field there. Two north poles are aimed toward each other in these toroidal magnets that are on this, that are moving along this plastic rod. And with this robot mechanism of mine, I apply a downward force to the upper toroidal permanent magnet, pushing it closer to the lower toroidal permanent magnet. And they start off 2 inches apart, and I push them until they are 1 inch apart. And my robot has got the right kind of instrumentation on it that it measures force at each millimeter of motion, and it measures distance each millimeter of motion. So I push it down 25.4 millimeters. I push it down 1 inch. I measure the amount of energy investment that I have made to that pair of magnets as a system. To that pair of magnets as a system, I can quantify the amount of energy I put in when I push them together. Somewhat like the energy I would be investing in a spring if I push the spring together. I compress the spring, a vertical spring on that rod. Strong similarity there. And when I allow my robot to now release and come back up, the force through distance will be the exact reverse of what I had on the way down. I'll get it on the way back. So the energy investment I made into that pair of magnets on the way down is the exact same amount of energy in general that I'm going to get when they...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's the exact same amount of energy that I'm going to get back when I slowly release the compression of those two magnets on the way back up. Do you disagree with that, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it looks that it makes sense what you say, but when you take the compressed spring, which actually... is springing back because of the molecular structure of the material. But we're dealing with one solid chunk of the material that has its own structure. Now, with the magnet, we're dealing with the two pieces of the material and nothing else. And this mysterious power that is being called magnetism. Now, when you press or compress this spring over the limit, or let's say instead of pushing, you're pulling. That means that would be better. you're pulling out that spring. So the spring recover. At a certain amount of times that you do that, the spring will get deformed or will break out. Guess what? With the magnetic field, whether you're pushing or pulling, you can do it millions of times, and the amount of energy stays the same. In reality, the magnet is losing its own power, but when you come 100 years later of this working magnet, and you see that you've got just a little less of the gap compared to the one that you had before, or maybe your son does it, or anybody else, then you say, I don't care that I see the losses. For me, it is over-unity. For me, is what I was looking for. For me, is energy for free. Now, you have a rear air magnet. Let me drop.
Question when you get a chance, Dick.
So, when you have a rare earth magnet, you can just take them and make the magnet. Did you ever see Dick rare earth spring? Back to you, Jit, Dick, and to XGN.
John recognized. When I stretch the spring instead of compressing it, I can go beyond the so-called elastic limit in which I permanently damage the spring and it doesn't thoroughly return. All physical materials have a elastic limit beyond which they crack, fracture, become a new shape, a new length, whatever. In the case of magnets, no matter how good your magnet is, it has a finite amount of coercivity. Most of the magnets that are used on waveguide circulators are two neodymium magnets packed in real close to a piece of ferrite-like material that really does the circulator action. Let me drop. And most of the very well-made ones have a pretty nice magnetic cage around the outside of the circulator. But in some cases, the manufacturer tried to make the circulator more compact, and he didn't put a good enough magnetic cage around the outside. He put a sign on it saying, do not bring magnetic materials within 1 inch of this circulator, otherwise you will partially degauss it. If you bring a great big screwdriver or another magnet too close to a circulator, you will change the amount of magnetic field. Therefore, you will be tuning your circulator to a new frequency. By the same token, with those two toroidal magnets that are on that plastic rod, if you give me a big enough, strong enough magnet for that upper toroidal magnet, you give me one that's big enough and strong enough, and you allow me to push it close enough to that lower toroidal magnet, I will partially degauss that lower magnet. Because I've got the two North Poles opposing each other, I will partially demagnetize that lower magnet. Conversely, if that lower magnet is south up instead of north up, and I bring a very strong magnet to it from the top, I can increase the amount of magnetic field of that lower magnet. So depending on the magnitude, the value of the coercivity, I can increase or decrease the magnetic field permanently of a so-called permanent magnet. And if you're not careful, many magnets can be partially degaussed. If it's got high enough coercivity, and if you're using it correctly, the amount of degaussing is so minor that it's hard to measure. But you've got to be careful with these magnets if you don't want to partially damage their great...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You got to be careful if you don't want to partially damage them. So I can damage a spring, I can damage a magnet, but I've made an investment when I did the original magnetization to force all of those domains to almost all of them line up.
Actually, you didn't do that. The earth did it. you're using neodymium magnet motors, Dick, and you have a 10 kilograms or 10,000 kilograms magnet, the math doesn't match when you're trying to compare it to spring, back to you.
All of those neodymium magnets did not happen naturally. That is an unnatural compound, that neodymium magnet. It's an unnatural man-made compound that was not magnetized when it first came out of the kiln. It then had to be applied to an extremely strong magnetic field to establish its magnetism. Mother Nature didn't do that. Yes, there are so-called lodestone, very weak magnets that Mother Nature did supply. But the really strong, modern-day, man-made magnets, that magnetism came from a very serious effort that mankind applied to that material after manufacture. That's an opinion. John, I know you want to make comments on all this. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, just a quick question. Once we take a piece of ferrous material and we magnetize it, as you said, and we align it, now, when we take it to absolute zero, do we have the same magnetic field, decreased magnetic field, or does it disappear? What, in your opinion, what do you think happens there at absolute zero?
Almost all magnetic materials have something called the Curie temperature, the Curie point, which means that when you go above that temperature on the high side, quite often they will lose magnetic field at the Curie temperature. To my knowledge, there is no equivalent of the Curie temperature on the low side. It is my belief that most magnetic materials brought down to microkelvins will keep their magnetic field, and now will it increase or decrease? That's a function of the thermal expansion coefficient of that material. Some materials, as you go cold, compress. So now those individual domains are closer together. I think there's a slim possibility that certain materials, when you cryogenically cool them, the local magnetic field might slightly increase because the magnetic material became a little bit more compact in the process of freezing it. That's my belief. Over to you, John. Wait for 4 seconds.
Okay. Sounds good enough to me. So it's actually going, it's possible it could concentrate the magnetic field even a little more because of the reduction in the square area and the ends. All right.
Dick, I have a question for you. Why then this rare earth magnet with millions of years didn't become demagnetized?
The so-called rare earth materials, like neodymium, are capable with proper manufacturing, when you make the right compound. Neodymium is not used all by itself. It's a neodymium, iron, cobalt. It's some kind of a compound. When you choose the right compound, you have artificially created a material that is capable of having very high coercivity. That means retention of magnetic fields. And once you've created that material and cooled it off, because it's a heating process by which you've created that compound, once you cool it off, it doesn't naturally have a significant amount of magnetism. It's got magnetic properties. It will be sucked over to a magnet that you bring it near. But if you want it itself to be a magnet, you have to go through a process of magnetizing it. You put an extremely strong magnetic field around it that forces those individual domains at the microscopic level to all line up, and hopefully they stay in that new alignment once you remove that magnetic field. So these neodymium materials, nothing in nature comes anywhere near at the handheld magnet level. Nothing in Mother Nature comes near, let me drop this, having the amount of magnetic field that you and I create when we go through the neodymium magnet creation. Now there's a catch to that. Mother Nature does make some extremely strong magnetic fields on certain kinds of collapsing of a star, which is called a magnetar. And there she can make magnetic fields that are zillions of times greater than anything you and I can even dream about. So Mother Nature does make some extremely strong magnetic fields, but she's doing it at the solar level, at the handheld device level. I don't think Mother Nature makes very strong magnets. She makes very weak magnets. Thank goodness the lodestones that the early mankind used to discover were just strong enough in magnetic field that you could discover that there was something called magnetism. But natural magnets on Earth, I think, are reasonably weak until you do something to them. N2XJN, wait 4 seconds, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I think you're going to be very, very much surprised when you take the powder of the rare earth magnets, put them into something. You don't have to pump them at all. And then you try the power of their magnetic field. You're going to be surprised with it. Back to you.
For a couple of minutes, let me get into a slightly more interesting subject. You trimmed some trees today around your antenna, and the 5KC offset that you used to have to do no longer took place. Let me show you something that I discovered. I'm looking at a vertical, what is it called now? Google Earth map of Anderson Avenue, of Andrews Avenue. I'm looking at Andrews Avenue in the vicinity of Metropolitan Avenue on the bottom, running east-west. Andrews Avenue runs north from it. And the next thing Andrews Avenue hits is 55th Street. When I look along Andrews Avenue and I look at the third building on the left-hand side, the third building on the west side, I see some overhanging trees from the second building toward the roof of the third building. Is that the tree that you trimmed? Because I'm going to show you something very interesting. Is that your building? Is that the tree that you trimmed? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, N2XJN. On my property, I have two houses. One is at the front, one is at the rear. My question before I answer that, and on the side of the front building that is next to the Andrews Avenue, there is another property where there is a tree. The tree is partially, was partially on the roof of my house. Is that what you see?
Okay, I see two houses that meet that requirement. The third house, going north from Metropolitan Avenue toward 55th Street on the west-hand side, is a fairly long house left to right, east to west. And maybe there's a front section and a rear section of that.
One, that's the one on the corner of Metropolitan Avenue and Andrews Avenue, right? That's the neighbor one, and right behind, from the rear of that, there is a tree.
Okay, I see some very significant trees. Now, I've got a brand new theory as to what was happening when you were getting all of that distortion, and you had to go 5KC off. If you go south on Andrew Avenue, until you hit Metropolitan Avenue, if you then go make a left-hand turn, and let's see now, I lost the picture. Oh, here it is. If you make a left-hand turn and then make a quick right onto Tonsor Street, you will come to a building that is a 10-story tall building. The 10-story tall building just happens to have exactly the right orientation to bounce a signal from your property over to the Glen Oaks repeater, which is 10 miles to your east-northeast. 10 miles to your east is the Glen Oaks repeater. And I am guessing that that 10-story tall building that is 600 feet from your property just happens to have the north wall, northeastern wall of that perfectly oriented to act like a mirror to reflect the signal into the Glen Oaks repeater. And any change that you make in the tree that is south of you, between your antenna and that building, changes the signal level that's bouncing off that building and changes whether or not you create a null in the pattern that gets to the Glen Oaks repeater 10 miles to your east. That's a theory. And if you hadn't trimmed the tree, I was about to suggest something that would make a difference. First of all, are you familiar with that 10-story building?
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
No, I'm not, but that's what you say actually very much makes a sense, and I believe that you discovered the nature of that multipath. Yes, there is no other explanation for this. I trimmed the tree, there is no longer nearby the antennas, and I've got a perfect signal, perfect modulation, no intermod, nothing. That's it.
Wesley, wasn't that touching your HF antenna, not your VHF antenna?
Yeah, it was touching my HF antenna, but it was probably on the path to that building that Dick is talking about.
Yeah, that building is due south of you. Did you make any change in the amount of tree, the density of the tree, the height of the tree, whatever? Did you make any change to the tree that would change the amount of signal on VHF that gets from your antenna to the south? Over to you, Wesley. Wait for a second.
Yes, I believe I did. I believe I did. I cut all of the branches that were at the same height of my 20-something, 25 feet of my HF antenna. I have two masts over there. One is for the HF and the other one is for 2 meters, 70 centimeters. They are no longer there, effective.
Yeah, my theory is that the signal going to the south, 600 feet away on the other side of Metropolitan Avenue, hit the wall of that 10-story high building, became a beautiful mirror-like reflector, reflecting a signal to the east. So the net result is your antenna is transmitting a signal that goes directly to the east, 10 miles away, to the Glen Oaks repeater. The reflected signal off of that building does the same thing. And at some very specific frequency, those two signals arrive equal in amplitude at Glen Oaks and out of phase. I was going to first ask you to try any other antenna at your QTH, a mag mount on a radiator, anything that can get to the repeater, any other antenna from the exact same radio, and I predict the effect wouldn't be there.
There is one more thing supporting the theory. John has discovered something with the strength of my signal.
Yeah, John is to your west-southwest, which also has to look through that tree, and now he's seeing a different signal strength. So the amount of signal in various angles has now changed because you trimmed that tree. You had a very delicate situation where you were building a 600-foot-long interferometer. In other words, you were emitting a direct signal from your property to Glen Oaks. Let me drop. And a second signal of almost equal amplitude was coming off this great big reflector off the building 600 feet to the south of you. It's a 10-story high building on the other side of Metropolitan Avenue. And so those two signals are arriving at Glen Oaks out of phase on the carrier frequency of 146.25. If that was true, if you hadn't trimmed the tree, I was going to have you move the frequency of your transmitter 1 kilohertz at a time. I know when you're in the FM mode, it jumps 5 kilohertz. Many of these rigs, when you go over to the sideband mode, you can move them 1 kilohertz at a time and then flip back to FM transmitting and hold that frequency. you could have moved it 1 kilohertz at a time, and I believe the distortion would have slowly disappeared as you slowly came out of that null of that interferometry phenomenon.
Yes, you're right. I did that. Menu number 3 in Kenwood 2000 does that. And I did that. That means I was changing slowly the frequency, and the distortion actually was slower or bigger. Never disappeared completely, because the last data has a tremendous problem. And yeah, John can actually comment on that.
And if I understand you correctly, you used more than one transmitter into that same antenna on the roof of your QTH, and they all had that distortion. So it's not due to the transmitter. It's due to free space, Mother Nature, and this interferometry effect. And so as you move that other transmitter 1 kilohertz at a time, you can make the distortion slowly change better or worse. What frequency was the worst, Wesley? Go ahead.
John, what frequency was the worst?
Let it drop. And Dick, at 250, he had that terrible sound. As he went up to 251, it got a little bit better. As soon as he hit 252, 253, it was horrible. Couldn't even understand it. As soon as he got to 255, it was slightly improved. So there was a big difference, although it was not like it was before, where he was almost crystal clear on 255. He was still distorted. But at 253, it was about the worst. So there were differences in one increment.
And that makes some sense. What I believe you are getting is what's called a selective null. In other words, at very specific frequencies of your FM modulated signal, the environment of this interferometry in my theory is creating a null. If you null out the carrier of an FM signal, you get a very heavy distortion. If you null out the first side lobe of the major portion of his voice, maybe his voice, excuse me, has a major component at, let's say, 600 hertz. And if you null out the 600 hertz, it's going to really sound heavily distorted. So you're going to go through some slow peaks and valleys as you move that frequency. But now, by him trimming that tree, he changed the magnitude of the signal that's reflecting off the building versus the magnitude of the signal going by direct path. He no longer has the perfect matching of those two amplitudes, therefore he no longer has that null. He's adjusted those amplitudes. Had he taken his antenna on the roof and simply moved it to another location, maybe 5 feet away, I think he would have also seen a change. So, if I understand correctly, he used more than one transmitter, and one of those transmitters he moved it 1 kilohertz at a time. Over to you, John, and then pass it back to Wesley. John's got it. KQLIW and TechNet. Wait 4 seconds.
Yeah, just mention, John, about the strength of the signal between us.
I will. Yeah, Dick, he never changed transmitters. He used the same 2000 that I had, and made all the tests with the same transmitters. Eric had brought a service monitor over there. His transmitter checked out perfectly. His SWR is excellent, so those weren't the issues. But I do know one thing. I got him at about 9 over here on the input frequency. He has a very good signal to my direction, but now I can listen to him on the input or the output of the repeater exactly the same. He pins the meter, and that is as soon as he did it, I knew that was the improvement.
So I've got one more thing. I was barely able to get John on 5657 with his he was using 15 watts, and then he increased to 50 and was barely. Now we tried to say with 5 watts, he's almost at the same strength what he's coming from the receiver. Thank you.
Yeah, the signal to me from you on the input is very close to the same it used to be. around S3 when I don't turn on the preamplifier. So in my direction, not a great deal has changed, although I'm at a slightly different angle from you compared to Glen Oaks. So I think you had a very classy selective null. It's a rare condition of multipath. Everything had to be balanced just right. When the leaves fell off that tree in the wintertime, I think it would have changed. But you've solved the problem. It was an antenna and environment problem, is all the evidence we're getting right now. And that's a very rare one. I've heard that before. That exact sound on a FM transmitter. I've also heard it on a sideband transmitter. Let me drop. I've heard it both on 2 meters and on 432. Every so often you get a cloud, like when I'm talking to somebody in Pennsylvania on 432, and somewhere in New Jersey there's a cloud that becomes highly reflective. And you hear the sideband signal with a kind of echo effect. It gives a kind of a distortion, a kind of an echo effect. So multipath, when the two paths just happen to equal each other. By the way, it took very careful aiming of my antenna, my 432 Yagi, in order to hear the effect. If I aimed directly at the cloud, it sounded clean. If I aimed directly at the person, it sounded clean. If I aimed halfway between the two, I heard the distortion. So I've seen this effect for short periods of time, like an hour at a time, on 432 with sideband. And you had it now for a couple of months in the summertime. For it to stay balanced that long is kind of amazing. But I think there's a medium chance we pinned down your very unusual condition. Over to you, Wesley. Wait for a second. K2RIW in the second half.
A quick comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, there's another permutation involved in this. It only happened after Eric installed a new antenna on the 850 machine. You have to realize that, too. Before, he had no problem.
Yeah, that slightly changed the pattern that it locally picks up. So that selective null that he's making with this 600-foot-long interferometer, see, he's launching some signal directly to the south to this great big reflecting billboard 10 stories high, 600 feet away from him. And those two signals arrive with a very complicated finger-like pattern when it gets to Glen Oaks. And that finger-like pattern is reflecting off of those buildings and local objects nearby. So minor changes in the antenna pattern at Glen Oaks again determines whether or not he gets a null, a selective null on some specific frequency, like carrier or specific modulating frequency of the FM. It took a weird combination for this to happen. And it sounds like we've almost gotten to the bottom of it. Over to you, Wesley. Wait 4 seconds.
Yeah, thank you very much. I do appreciate it. I did not even realize how much effort you have made to help me out and to investigate that. So I'm very much thankful. Thank you, Dick. And so is it.
Now, once again, in the case of magnets, these neodymium magnets are a very fancy man-made compound that has very high magnetic capability, very high coercivity, capable of making very strong magnets. But they don't come out of the factory with that magnetic field until you go through the process of cooling the material and magnetizing it. And every one of those neodymium magnets, you heat them up enough, they will lose almost all of that magnetic field. They'll hit the so-called Curie temperature for that material. And for neodymium, I'm not sure what the Curie temperature is, but I know your blowtorch can definitely get there. So you don't want to go there. But when it comes to cryogenic cooling, I think they're going to keep their magnetic field. And once you've done this magnetization of the material, and now you set up two magnets on a rod, two toroidal magnets on a rod, pushing them together, I think is a little bit like storing energy of pushing a spring together. And when you slowly release the spring, you get that energy back. When you slowly release the two magnets, you get that energy back. That's my belief. Over to you, Wesley. Wait 4 seconds. K2RIW in the second half.
Yeah, interesting. Well, see, Dick, you cannot explain the molecular structure that is actually taking the energy from you and reversing the energy with the vector up. Well, the major difference is that with the spring, you're dealing with the one solid piece of the material that has a certain molecular structure, and you're dealing then with whole of the structure. Now, as far as we're dealing with the magnets, we have two solid molecular structures and nothing in between. But the nothing in between is being called magnetic field. So the theory of actually the transferring energy is simply kind of colliding in this area. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anyone really knows what that magnetic field external to the permanent magnet, what it really looks like. Yes, we can. You can make devices with powdered iron, and you can trace out those magnetic fields. You know where the lines go. And we call it lines of magnetic field. And we can also call it, in the case of something like the Earth, we can call it lines of gravity field. And through a whole bunch of experience, we know the way gravity behaves. Through a bunch of experience, we know how magnetic field behaves. But what do those two fields really look like? That's a tough one. At the molecular level or in the free space area, what do they really look like? We know that they appear to be domains, which I think have been seen with an electron microscope, in the material itself. Those domains, I think they've actually seen those domains lining up. With a scanning tunneling microscope, I think they've really seen those domains and the crystalline faults that you get that move when you magnetize the material. I think that's been confirmed. So what's happening in the magnet itself is somewhat understood. But the external field of a magnet certainly looks like a lot of magic. There was another subject I wanted to discuss. Let me drop for a second.
WA2EGT, comment.
EGT, start up with your name. Wait 4 seconds before you talk.
Okay, great. Dick, this is WA2EGT. My name is Charlie. And, Dick, I just want you to know that I've been listening to the TechNet for 8 years, and I want to thank everyone who made the contribution. I did have a comment. I wanted to rewind the TechNet tonight. Facts are very ominous, but you guys are in a pretty intense discussion here, so I'll just be hanging on the side. And, thanks for acknowledging me. This is WA2EGT.
Why don't you ask your variometer question, Charlie?
Actually, Dick, my first question is, how is my signal? I hate to be so trite, but I don't operate repeaters. This is probably my third repeater contact in my 42 years as a ham. Okay, I'm an HF or a brass pounder and sometimes satellite operator. What is the timeout for me to drop it? Exactly what is that time? Over.
Once every minute and a half, you have to drop the carrier and wait for a beep. And once every 3 or 4 minutes, that dropout should last for 4 seconds so that the internet connections by way of IRLP get reset. I'm hearing you very nicely on the input, and you're dead full quieting into the machine, Charlie, so you sound good. Go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, that's great. Sorry about that. Anyway, for 4 seconds. My apologies to Eric if he's listening while he's in Florida. I'm sorry. I have a little bit of mic shyness also, which probably explains why I was a brass pounder for all these years. It really wasn't a question, Dick. It was a comment. I noticed that there, to me at least, there's a confusion between variometers and link coupling systems. The term variometer is very specific, and it was for a continuously variable inductor that had no mechanical contact, no rollers, no sliders.
And yes, it did show up in Atwater Kent, early receivers. I heard... I'm going to drop it. Okay, I just picked up a clock here. I don't know how much this is going to help me. What the variometers were used in early transmitters, because of the high RF currents, you had no mechanical contacts to deal with. You were using Atwater Kent receivers. And when I heard this earlier, I threw together the station. Clock radio went off. Just a comment, and it took a while. But I ran around also, and I found my Terman textbook. This is, and he covers variable inductances, and specifically the variometers. This book was published in 1937, and that was mentioned before about old publications, how wonderful they are to have around. But the inductance will vary from zero to, and let me just throw this at you, 2L times the quantity 1 minus K, or 1 plus K, and K is the coefficient of coupling. So you get to 90 degree. This was another question, I'm sorry, and I'm going to drop it and ask you, I didn't hear the URL for Wesley's YouTube demonstration, and I've been listening fairly well. I was wondering if we can get that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I can give it to you now. It's very easy.
Go right ahead, Wesley.
All you got to do is go to YouTube, and you can put variometer video, and then put pound one, which would be standing for number one. The pound sign, variometer video pound one. You're going to get it. Then another one would be the variometer pound two. And that would be for the video number two. Video number one utilized Hewlett-Packard impedance gain phase analyzer number 4194A and the advanced network analyzer R3754B is on the video number two. But you?
Gordon recognized, but Charlie first. Go ahead, Charlie.
Okay, Dick, that's great, Wesley. I appreciate that. Just for your information, for a number of years, I was married to an HP 8753E network analyzer that I absolutely loved. And at home, I struggled with an HP 8407A, which I believe was the first network analyzer that HP made. It's from 100 kilohertz, 110 megahertz, but that's another story. Again, getting back to the variometer, I also heard mention of it being used in the ARC 5 series. Now, I owned an ARC 5. It was a PC457A, and this transmitter it had a pair of 1625s in parallel to a link coupling arrangement. The primary side was tuned. Secondary side was untuned, but it was fed to a roller inductor that was a loading coil. The other side of the loading coil was the antenna. So basically, it is link coupling. And again, the variometer was just a clever, clever way of varying inductance without any kind of physical contact. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to microwave circuits on frequencies like 6 meters and above, particularly on 2 meters, 432, and 1296, link coupling, in the case of tube transmitters in particular, link coupling is very frequently used on both the input circuit and the output circuit of a tube amplifier. Link coupling has been used lots and lots of years. And most guys set up the link coupling as some kind of a resonator on the input circuit and a resonator on the output circuit and a loop of wires, so to speak, going to the output connector adjust the coupling coefficient. And by setting up the size of the link and the spacing of the link from the resonator determines the coupling coefficient. And quite often that's arrived by a cut-and-try experimental process. Let me drop. guys doing that cut-and-try process have discovered that the size of the link, the spacing of the link from the resonator, and the orientation of the link all affect coupling coefficient. In the case of a variometer, it's a nicely put together thing where you have a very specifically adjustable amount of link coupling, everything from very close to zero to very close to unity or maybe above, depending on how the resonators are set up. So a variometer is a much more sophisticated version of link coupling that has often been used. And so it's got a very rich history. And it's a classy circuit. And because it's no longer mentioned, the variometer, in modern-day schools, and because very few modern-day instruments use them, it's sort of fallen into a disservice or disuse. And various of the Arc 5 series of transmitters and receivers, some of them do use variometers. I'm not sure if all of them do or not. That roller ductor was very popular. Let me drop. A lot of the Arc 5 HF transmitters use that roller ductor. And when that silver plating on that roller ductor was in good shape, they worked very well. As the silver plating wore away, and you get down to raw brass, they start becoming a little bit more scratchy in their tuning characteristics. And the amplifier that I worked on, called the 432 megacycle stripline parallel kilowatt amplifier, April and May 1972 QSD, I got away from any kind of sliding contacts. I discovered that whenever there's sliding contacts, whether it be a screw adjusting technique or sliding finger stock to do tuning at microwave frequencies like 432, you eventually get galling and scratchy contacts and unreliable operation. So I came up with these flapper capacitors. Me and some guys that helped me came up with these flapper capacitors, bendable pieces of sheet metal that do the tuning, and therefore there's no sliding contact. And the efficiency and repeatability becomes a hell of a lot better when you do that. And at 432 megacycles, to make a variometer as a variable coupling coefficient could have been done, but on an 8-inch wide piece of strip line as the resonator, to set up a variometer in there as opposed to a flapper capacitor would have been a little bit difficult. When you see the physical layout of that transmitter by going to April or May QST 1972, and you go to the ARRL archives to look at that, you'll see that putting a variometer in there as opposed to the variable coupling coefficient capacitor for the output network, that amplifier uses a simpler technique in modern day terms, in my opinion. Gordon, I bet you used some variometers in your time. Whiskey 2, Tango, 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 K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait 4 seconds.
Another comment, if you will be.
Yeah, we'll get back to you, Charlie. Gordon first. Go ahead, Gordon.
Okay, very good. K2RIW and the TechNet, W2TTT. Well, I got a couple of things. Boy, a lot of just stuff just poured into my head. Number one, I recently picked up in a junk box at our BARA, the Bergen Amateur Association, has a monthly junk box that's sealed. Someone puts it together with a bunch of stuff, and then they auction it off blind. And one of those variometers with the roller inductor was given to me, including the drive mechanism, everything. So I have one of those, and I have a matching capacitor out of something else that's equally as artful. Kind of wide space, but not super wide space. So I'm thinking someday I'll build a really nice antenna tuner out of it, or maybe even a transmitter. Breadboard style transmitter, just for something goofy to play with, like maybe 40 meters or something, or 80 meters. Number two item, let me drop it. Okie doke. Number two item was, I can tell you that when I was in St. Ignatius Loyola in Manhattan in 8th grade and bored out of my mind waiting to go to high school, reading QST, and specifically the article about the 432 amplifiers in April and May did help me through the years, and it wasn't until years later, I read about the flapper capacitor, and I said, gee, isn't that interesting, I wonder what that really does, but okay, I get it, but that was a cool technique, and very, very revolutionary for the time. So Dick, thank you for intellectual stimulation for a bored eighth grader. And finally, my other question is, I'm going to go home and watch Wesley's videos on the variometers on YouTube, but I got to ask, how does Wesley come up with a continental European accent with the name Wesley? It's a personal question, but I'm just kind of curious. So I'll hand it back to Wesley, if you don't mind, Dick, and then you take it. W2DTT. Okay, I guess Wesley is up there.
Wesley is an Americanization of his name. His name is very difficult to pronounce in with a Western mouth. His first name is spelled W-I-E-S-L-A-W. To a person from Poland, that's an easy thing to pronounce. To us non-Polish people, that's a very difficult one. So Wesley is close enough, and that's what I think is going on. Gordon, go ahead.
D-Slav is good. Hold on. James wants to say something. Wait, James doesn't want to say something. All right. Anyway, but it seems like D-Slav, it works for me anyway. But then again, my wife's maiden name was Bajowski or Lajowska.
Oh-ho. So for you it's easy. Okay, Charlie wanted to make another comment. The B2 Echo Golf Tango. Go ahead, Charlie. K2RIW in the second half. Wait 4 seconds.
This is WA2ECT. Thanks, Dick. Dick, I don't mean to be controversial here. I tend to like the history of words and so forth, and I think that's what this is a case of, where this arrangement of a primary winding and a secondary winding that can be rotated on an axis maybe started with this variable inductor, this variometer, and then it just took off as a means of link coupling also, and the term was generally applied. I think that's maybe what's going on here. As far as the etymology goes, you know, this book is 1937 from Sherman. I don't see many references in other publications to variometers. This was the most specific one. I'm sorry I'm taking up the text time on this trivial crap. I'm going to have to accept my apology. Back to you, Dick, to the WA2ECT.
Of all the ways of making a link coupling network, one could say that the variometer technique, where one coil is able to rotate inside of another coil, is probably the more sophisticated way of doing it, the more pure way. And to me, a variometer is a subset of a goniometer. A goniometer is where, on the outside of the rotatable coil, you have a whole lot of individual coils displaced in a circumferential manner. In other words, you could put one at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and so on. And there are kinds of electronically steerable antennas where you could, if you want to, have 12 individual vertical ground plane antennas set up in a circular pattern with 12 pieces of transmission line coming over to these 12 individual coils that are displaced around this one center rotating coil. And now as you rotate that center coil, which is connected to the transmitter, you're determining what amplitude and what phase angle of signal is going to the individual 12 antennas. And you can electronically steer that beam. And you put a motor on that thing and rotating it at some ridiculous rate. And that is close to what the original VOR stations did, the VHF omnidirectional ranging stations. Let me drop. It is possible in the very beginning they had a much